This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Most educators agree that teaching ethics is an important part of a medical education. What they don't agree on is when to start.
The incredible importance of really being very actively involved further on, not just in the clerkships, but even in the graduate medical education.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about teaching ethics to medical students. We'll also hear from a college student about her education in the arts and the effects starting early in life had on her progress. Then a conversation about summer vacation and keeping all that good education from the school year safe between your students' ears. Finally, we'll spend an academic minute checking the color of monkey parts, because come on, they're monkey parts, and we've never talked about them before. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Last week, we had a really good discussion about the state of medical education today, but one thing we did not touch on was ethics, specifically how to teach would-be doctors and nurses ethics and when to start. Dr. David Magnus seemed to be the right person to tap for that conversation. Dr. Magnus is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and the Thomas A. Raffin Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. We spoke recently, and I asked him when was the right time to introduce ethics into a medical education.
So that's a really interesting and really tough challenge. Figuring out the right place to introduce ethics in medical education, there's a tendency to really put it into the pre-clerkship year, which is just way too early. We try and do our best when we're talking to students at that level, and essentially it's an inoculation mode. The idea is if we get them thinking about ethics early on, it inoculates them from things that happen later. But there's an awful lot of data showing that there's something that's referred to in the literature as ethical erosion, that as patients are learning to become physicians, some of their views and attitudes about the importance of respect for their patients and informed consent erode over time as they get more and more exposed to clinical practice. And what it highlights is the incredible importance of really being very actively involved further on, not just in the clerkships, but even in the graduate medical education. Because I think actually where the rubber meets the road about what kind of physician someone's going to be, it's really in their residency and in their fellowship that that really takes place. And so I think it's really important. And there's starting to be a rise of interest and an emphasis on trying to improve ethics education in the residency programs, because I think that's so critically important. Just to take one trivial, not trivial example, one important example, being able to have a good conversation and do a good job communicating with patients around end-of-life issues and delivering bad news is critically important for lots of physicians, but especially those who are specializing in hematology and oncology, where you know they're going to be dealing with those kinds of issues on a regular basis. And yet, if you look at the data, that last data that was published, most residency, or fellowship programs in HEMOC devote very, very little time to teaching these incredibly important skills. And so finding a way to have those more time and to increase the amount of time that that ethics is taught in all the different residency programs and fellowship programs is going to be critical if we're going to be able to do a better job than we currently do, where almost all the data shows communication is poor, informed consent isn't achieved, and we generally just don't do a great job with dealing with, as we should, with the sort of human aspects of patient care.
How has it changed from 20, 25 years ago? Is there a more emphasis on it now?
I think there is an increase. Everybody sort of recognizes that you have to have ethics included in the curriculum. It's required by LCME. So if you're going to be accredited medical school, you have to have it included in different ways. It's been recognized by ACGME, so residency programs theoretically have to have it included. So there's been that growing recognition, and there's been a push for that. So I think it has. There's been some increase, but I think we're still far, far from what we really need in terms of really doing an adequate job of training our future physicians.
Going forward, how do you see this progressing?
That's a tough one. I think a lot is going to depend on actually research. The more we study inadequacies in communication among physicians, that's sort of an indictment of our training and how what kind of a job we're doing. If we can get to the point where we get scalable quality improvement measures around communication in the same way we deal with the way we deal with in trying to fight infection rates or decubitus rates in the hospitals, I think that will be the impetus of big change. So in most areas of life, we're used to hearing when you're on the phone, this conversation may be recorded for quality improvement purposes. You never hear that at the doctor's office. So if that changes and we start routinely recording conversations, having them analyzed, and physicians get back scores telling them whether they're doing a good job of communicating or not, I think that will be the, and that becomes a standard part of quality improvement measures, I think that's when you'll start to see shifts in physician behavior and then in education.
Dr. David Magnus is the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and the Thomas A. Raffin Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. While there may be some disagreement on when to start teaching ethics, most agree it's never too early to start teaching the arts. Producer Vanessa Renee from Brooklyn College Radio reflects on the usefulness of an arts education and choosing a career in the arts.
I got into the arts when I was really young. My parents put me in piano lessons, dance, and art classes, and I went to a performing arts high school to learn vocal music. I was constantly around artists, musicians, and actors who were as serious and as passionate about their talents as I was.
I think what I loved most about LaGuardia was the experience that you had to nurture your talent in different ways.
That was Zelly. We both graduated from LaGuardia's music program.
Even if you were not someone who wanted to pursue classical music, which is what the program was mostly structured around, there were options for extracurriculars like gospel or show choir, and I thought that was cool to be able to explore different opportunities.
A lot of us in our graduating class took it for granted that we were in a space that was always supportive of its students. Angela, another one of our classmates, explains that the teachers at LaGuardia
felt that our passion was their passion, and like every time that we would create something, they'd smile and, you know, try to make it as good as they thought it could be. That was part of the challenge. That was part of making yourself better as an artist and as a performer.
Angela was in the New Music Ensemble,
which was basically a class devoted to writing your own music and preparing you to be in the singer-songwriting scene when you left.
One of her favorite teachers and the director of the ensemble was
Robert Apostle. He was just the coolest teacher. He wouldn't give us assignments. He would just say, okay, you have this amount of time, write a song and be gone. And you work with as many musicians as you want. I just remember meeting with everyone, and our place was the staircase, and it would just be so heavenly to hear everybody's voices to collaborate in that one moment. And it was just that awesomeness of blending and being together as a family, as, you know, as co-writers. It was so great. It's pulling me back, oh, you're pulling me back. I'm holding the light, crashing the night, burning in the back, it's been one again. I trip in the night, fumble the night, stumble in the back in your arms again.
Towards junior and senior year, though, I felt this underlying pressure that would rear its ugly head at the end of every completed college application. Where would I go to school? What would I study? As much as I love singing, I didn't think it was realistically or financially possible for me to pursue it at a conservatory. I mean, I'm really happy I fell into the television and radio major when I did, because it ended up being something that was both, quote-unquote, responsible, and something I'm really passionate about now. But I can't help but feel similarly as I did at the end of high school, as I'm nearing graduation at Brooklyn College.
What do you do with the BA in English? What is my life going to be? 4 years of college and plenty of knowledge have earned me this useless degree.
Preston, who sings the opening number from the musical Avenue Q, gets it. In college, you're both encouraged to try out new things and figure out what you love, but at the same time, you're expected to prepare to compartmentalize your life. Brooklyn College student Amy further explains.
For a lot of creative fields, like, you're going to make almost no money. I would say, like, find a really good day job that you love, but also a day job that like doesn't drain you so emotionally that you can't write or do whatever it is you want to do on the side.
But why should we have to put our passions on the side?
I think art is something that a lot of people look down upon, and they feel it's not realistic. It's not the safe route to go.
That was Greg, a film major at Brooklyn College.
I feel as if no one takes in mind that growing up, arts played such a huge part in child development. You know, they're taught through pictures and these children's books. That's how we eventually started to appreciate storytelling.
Angela agrees.
There's such an importance in the idea of having arts in school, whether that's high school, college, even classes on the side of school. But people don't see that. People see what will get them money and what will make them progress with money, you know? And music isn't the sought out thing for money. One of the main reasons people drop those dreams is because they have other people saying, well, you shouldn't, you should really pursue something with, you know, with a lot of merit.
She's right. I know so many people who have harbored these passions and dreams since childhood, but have had to abandon them as they grew up in order to be sensible.
At this point, there's so many people pursuing everything that everything is hard to do. The people telling you what to do, the people telling you, I guess, what to study, aren't going through it. You are. They went through it already.
Amy believes that pursuing these dreams, as risky as they are in our society, is worth it.
We only have this particular life once, and would you rather spend that, like, fulfilling the status quo because you're scared of taking risks and you're scared of, let's say, like, making under 40K a year? Or would you rather just go all out and like chase after what you want, even if it's harder? In the arts, you have to make huge sacrifices to live that kind of life. And so it reminds me like why those sacrifices are worth it.
In my utopia, education would be more than just taking certain classes that build a practical major. Rather, it would place more of an importance on developing a balanced artistic side. The talents and skills that we develop in making art help us think about everything differently, allowing us to solve problems and evaluate situations critically and creatively. Art, in all its forms, is a living medium that grows and changes with the people that make it and experience it. We need more avenues of accepting that, especially in our education system. I'm Vanessa Renee.
Still to come, summer vacation is just about here. How can you keep students from falling behind while enjoying their time off? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them on in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Now let's face it, summer's supposed to be fun for both students and their families. The carefree and school-free days of summer can serve to provide students with a much-needed break from the classroom. But students who take a complete break from learning over the months of summer can lose up to 2 to 3 months of learning while their brains are resting from the previous curriculum. Here to talk about ways to prevent some of this summertime brain drain is Barbara Dianis, an education specialist and author of Grade Transformer for the Modern Student Early High School Edition. We spoke recently and I asked, come on, don't students deserve a break after a long school year?
Well, it's always a temptation just to leave kids alone and say it's time to take an academic break. You've worked hard all year. But unfortunately, students who do take that full academic break at any grade level will find themselves, according to the Graham study that was concluded in 2011 and other studies that have followed that, that students will lose between 2 and 3 months of their scholastic learning over the summer. And so, therefore, when they return to the school in the fall, instead of being ahead where they were, where they finished up the school year in May or June, depending on the school system, they'll find themselves back 2 and 3 months.
Does it make a difference? Does age or grade level make a difference about how, you know, hard you have to go with this?
Well, it really doesn't. You know, the rule of thumb that I've used with my students for the past 21 years and actually longer is if they didn't do well academically in one or more subject areas and they're struggling in school, then they might want to put 45 minutes to an hour 5 days a week in. And that can be broken up into, you know, 10-minute segments. It could be 20-minute segments. It doesn't have to be they sit down for a full hour at one time and study. They can have it broken up, which is, you know, very much fine. And they can play learning games to make it more interesting and even incorporate some of their friends into the learning games. And if they have done well in school, I would say 30 minutes would be really adequate for a student who has been able to master scholastic core concepts and do well. 30 minutes is usually optimal time for them.
And are we talking about actually cracking open books and doing exercises, or would it be playing educational games, things just to keep the kids' mind active?
Well, what I found with my students, if they enjoyed learning and felt it was being presented in a game format, they were much more likely to be responsive and not as resistant students. And so in any scholastic area, you can, you know, the kids can take core concepts they're going to be learning in the fall, and they can make, you know, little flashcards and make it into a game show format to play with their friends. Or they can get some, the teacher supply store has many grammar learning games. They've got learning games in really in any subject area that can be incorporated into the summer scholastic study times.
Usually you don't get much input from a child's teacher other than a summer reading list. Is this something that parents should be asking teachers? What should my student be doing over the summer to keep up?
Absolutely, because teachers generally have a very good understanding of each student and what their scholastic strengths and weaknesses are. So if a parent isn't sure, and if they haven't really followed the work, the graded work and assignments and the grades online, and they're not sure what areas their student really needs more help in, they definitely should contact the teacher or teachers the student may have and say, you know, what would you recommend? What are the areas that you feel my child or teenager could really benefit from reviewing over the summer?
It really runs the gamut. I mean, you're talking about, you know, the same thing being definitely different lessons, the same thing for a first grader to a junior in high school. How different and how intense should it be for those, you know, two very different age groups?
Well, they are very different age groups, but they all need some sort of scholastic, you know, work during the summer to keep their brains active, whether they're a first grader, whether they're a junior in high school. So really it just is tailored around their own curriculum, their own strengths and weaknesses, and what they're going to be learning in the fall, especially if there's a subject area they haven't done as well in. For instance, if you have a student who maybe have some math challenges, it would be very advantageous for them to go back to what they learned in math the previous school year in their mathematics class, whichever level it is, and go back over the formulas that they may have learned or just the procedures, and then go back and re-look at the vocabulary of math. So many students have math problems, I found, because they don't understand the vocabulary of math, and therefore when the teacher might be introducing something, whether it's first grade or 11th grader, they may be lost in the vocabulary of what the teacher's presenting. So that's also an area for any student to do, is go back and relook at the vocabulary and then do some pre-learning of the types of vocabulary in math that they're going to be facing in the fall.
We talked about math. What about reading? Like I said, we do get those reading lists every year. Should they go beyond just that suggested reading?
Absolutely. You know, students should start with the suggested reading list and pick several books off of that reading list to work on. But they also really benefit from, no matter what age level they are, the classical literature books. And I know that sounds, for some students, they'll say, well, why would I want to read classical literature books? But so many of them are very good, and they can find the ones that tailor more to their interest levels. And they will find that it really helps build their intellectual skills if they add one or two classical literature books. And they can find that from their list of the classical literatures for their age group from the public library or on the internet.
What about making, you know, field trips during the summer a little more educational, going to a science museum, that type of thing?
Absolutely. Any field trip, like a museum or even going to see maybe a play for their age level is excellent for kids. Or if they have an arboretum, like we in Dallas have a Dallas Arboretum that has a whole area of science lessons for kids. Any activity like that will certainly help the children or teenagers at any level. And if they don't have access to museums or whatever, they can certainly benefit from some of the History Channel's programs on TV and some of the KRA, you know, the public television classical series that might show concerts and other different intellectual plays and operas and those types of presentations.
Okay, the most important question of all, how can I do all this and keep my child from hating me?
Well, how I present it to my students is I look at the fact that in a given week you have 168 hours. And say that the child who struggled the most in school has to dedicate 5 of those hours to learning. They have 163 hours not to be learning. And just make it fun and just say, we're going to have a good time doing this. We're going to play some English games. We're going to write some fun writing paragraphs. And we're going to write about what we might do in the summer we'd like to do. Or look up some interesting facts about a country you're interested in. And just make it really fun and just present it as it doesn't have to be sit down for an hour. We can break it up. We can just have a good time learning. And this will help you in the fall. And you will thank me later for it.
Barbara Dianis is an education specialist and author of Grade Transformer for the Modern Student, Early High School Edition.
Summer's here, I'm for that. I got my rubber sandwich, got my straw hat. I got my cold beer, I'm just glad that it's here.
So what's next? What's next? Ah, nothing like a good discussion about the color of monkey parts to round out a full half hour. Yes, that is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The colorful monkeys get all the girls. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Jennifer Kramer, an assistant professor at American Public University, explores the benefits of being bright blue.
Recent stories in the media have focused on blue color as interesting and rare in animals. Among primates, colorful skin is important for social and sexual communication. Male vervet monkeys have a colorful genital and perineal area and engage in red, white, and blue displays to show off their colors. In an effort to better understand how blue scrotal color varies in wild vervets, I collected digital photographs of hundreds of wild male vervets across Africa and the Caribbean. In all populations, I found that young vervet males before puberty are dull blue-gray in color. By the time males are subadults and adults, they fall into one of two categories, colorless, appearing white, or colorful, appearing blue or aquamarine. Geography is key. In West Africa and the Caribbean males, both phenotypes are observed, but in southern and eastern Africa, only the colorful phenotype is observed. Exploring the most colorful subspecies further, I studied the color, stress, hormone levels, and behavior of adult males in two troops of wild vervet monkeys in South Africa. Darker blue males have lower stress hormone levels, perhaps communicating the level of physical or social stress a male is experiencing to others. Unlike early field studies that found that males use their color in the red, white, and blue display to communicate dominance, I did not find a relationship between male color and rank or dominance behaviors. Interestingly, adult males with bluer color have higher rates of bullying juveniles in their group, but not their adult peers. Only recently have ornithologists discovered how blue color is structurally created in the skin of some birds and mammals. The next step is more exploration of why this rare color came to be in these species. These monkeys have color vision similar to humans, which highlights that the evolution of this brilliant color may be connected to the ability to produce and use flashy visual signals to communicate.
That was Jennifer Kramer of American Public University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.